You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can on the Broadway Podcast Network. I have a guest who is a colleague and a peer, and I got to know him when we were both elected officials on the union. Is that right?
Yeah.
And he is an actor. He's a director. He's a dramaturg. He is a dancer. He's a playwright. And I saw on your website that you have the sonnet play. So join me in welcoming my guest today, Brian Myers Cooper. And maybe you can do a sonnet and explain to me what the sonnet plays are. There's a good opener.
Well, first of all, dancer was a long time ago. And I don't lay claim to that one anymore.
Oh, you look like you were a dancer, though.
I danced. I'd never danced as well as the choreographers I worked with hoped that I would.
Yeah, that was me too.
Because I just, it was never my passion.
But you have the line.
I did.
I had a
very good sense of it. And so, you know, if you work with me, I would come up with the goods. But I never really wanted to do that. And I knew that. I also knew my body wouldn't hold up. And I thought, well, that's not really the career I want.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I came out of school. I had danced every day at Carnegie Mellon. And I went to like a couple of little dance gigs. And it was like, they were always calling us boys and girls. And I was like, these dancers, they work harder than everybody. They're called boys and girls forever. I want to be the person out in front who the dancers make look good. Like they do all the work behind them. And the person in the front just smiles and moves from side to side.
Yeah, I found that I just like storytelling. Mm. I like to tell the story. I like to even just my little piece of it. And while the dancing was fun when I was young, I knew that that wasn't the storytelling that I was passionate about. So I was like, well, yeah, when those roles, when the young dumb blonde virgin roles sort of started
drying up. Did you get the young dumb blonde virgin roles?
I made a career of the young dumb blonde virgin.
Okay.
The Will Parkers of the world.
Okay.
That was absolutely.
Where are you from?
I'm originally from Ohio.
Ohio. You know,
southeastern corner of Ohio.
The place of the Klan originated.
Oh, lovely. Yeah.
They were right down the street, I'm sure. Actually, I had my cinematographer on my film that I made this year, Red Pill. He said the Klan had a church down the street from his house, and it's still there.
Oh,
and they, like, at one point, like, you know, vandalized the school. But he's like, that's just, like, you know, the neighborhood thing. Like Jeremy O'Hare said, you know, the plantations were down the road, and his dad would sing Dixie in the car. So, you know, this is just some people, that's just home. It's just home.
Well, we didn't.
He has turned so red here. If you could see this red face.
Yeah. I'm from a part of Ohio where we don't have cities. Like if Ohio is a box, there's a city in every corner and in the middle, but not in our corner, which is the lower right-hand corner.
So what did you live
corner.
In, a town?
I lived outside of a town. I lived outside of a town that had less than about like 800 people. And we lived on the farm outside of that. We were out in the middle of nowhere. Speaking of, well, not the Klan necessarily, but, you know, that farm that I grew up next to, was my grandmother's farm, and her ancestors had homesteaded it, which means the government gave it to them after they stole it from the Indians.
Got it.
So, you know, in 1816, there's a whole rabbit hole of privilege that goes along with always having that piece of land.
Is
that
it still
was
in the family?
It is not. That piece of land is not. My grandmother passed away some years ago, and most of it was sold. The little parcel around the house was not. My uncle lived in it until he passed away about 5 or 6 years after that. And then that was sold. So now none of that original parcel is in our family.
What
and
is
my
your
father's farm?
Farm
is next door.
Oh, you grew up on a farm?
I grew up on a farm, yes.
Okay, what kind of farm? Come on, farmers, we don't get to talk to people who come from that.
It was a beef farm.
Beef.
Yeah, cows.
Okay.
Herford cows.
Herford cows.
Yeah.
Did y'all get to eat beef or did you only get to sell it?
Oh, no. We ate almost exclusively beef. My father did not like chicken unless it was Kentucky Fried, which was a rare treat because we lived in the middle of nowhere. There was no fast food.
But couldn't you just have some little chickens running around?
No. We didn't have, we did trade beef for other things like a side of pig. So you trade with other farmers and you would give them a side of beef and they would give you a side of pork. And so we had sausage, that was a big thing, and bacon, but really it was a beef farm and there was no fish and there was no chicken. And yeah.
And how many siblings?
One, my sister, younger.
And so what's the chores for beef farming kids?
So we grew up in 4-H. In fact, I just saw this girl on this young girl, maybe 10, 11, 12, on the subway. And on her backpack, she had a 4-H patch. And I was like, is there 4-H
still
in New York City?
And did you ask her?
I didn't. I didn't want to
be like a pervert.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but is there 4-H in you? But 4-H was big where I came.
Okay.
Where I came from. And so, you know,
Tell everybody what 4-H is because people don't know what 4-H is.
It is an agricultural youth program. And much like Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, but for agricultural rural kids. And you could take courses in everything from cooking and macrame and sewing and you know all sorts of domestic things and also animal husbandry. So I had rabbits. I had I showed pigs. That's a treat. my dairy friends had their dairy cows, and I had steers as well. I mean, so
did you ride any of them, or didn't you ride in any of these steers?
No, we didn't ride steers. No. We had horses that we used to. To corral everything.
I mean, you know, this is an ancient way of life that you're talking about now.
It is. And it was just sort of brought back to me as I, you know, looked at this girl's patch. I was like, oh my God, that was a lifetime ago. I moved here in 1989 and I've lived here longer than I've lived anywhere, obviously.
Right.
And I'm like, wow. Like it's almost like I'm rereading a book, this little fantasy novel that I read in 1985, something like that. And I just happened to find it. And I was like, oh, Let me see what that's about. And I'm sort of remembering because it made an impact on me at the time because there were gay characters. It's a trio of books by an author named Diane Duane.
Okay.
And sci-fi and you know it's lovely. But in 1980 whatever, there were gay characters in this. It was very sexually free.
Do you know the name of this book? What was this book?
The Doorway into Different Things. Doorway into Darkness. Doorway into it's a trio. So after all these years, I find this thing and I, you know, I download it on my Kindle and I'm reading it and I'm really thinking, remembering reading it, sitting on the floor of this apartment in Atlanta where I was working two fast food jobs in the summer between 2 years of college and eating a Swanson's beef pot pie because one of the characters actually had a pot pie and an inn in this world. Anyway, I was like, wow, that was me? Like, it seems like I'm remembering a character in another world.
What's the religion were you raised?
So I was raised in a Presbyterian church.
Presbyterians.
A very, very, very small Presbyterian church.
I mean, you said about 1,000 people, like everybody knew everybody in your
church. Everyone knew everyone. And the church where I grew up in its heyday, it was, I guess, much bigger, but when I was there, if there were 25 or 30 people at a service, that was big. And today, my mother still goes there, and there are 15 extant living members,
wow.
Like actually just 15 members of the church, and that includes my sister and I. And we obviously are not regular attenders, so
wow.
it is very small.
And you, parents still alive?
We lost my father in July.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. But my mother still lives on the farm.
You still got beef?
No. They don't. They have they retired from farming some time ago, and they sold everything, and they rent out the land.
Okay.
To a lot of Amish farmers around.
So the land is still farmed.
The land is still farmed.
They didn't have to come to fracking.
No, it did do that too. That whole area is full of shale and it went to fracking. My father held out, but in the scheme of things, the water table is the water table. So if your neighbors have done it, then you've done it. So you might as well get paid. So he held out and got paid more. You know, it's a real shame and it's a real concern. Like I look at that land because was not mine, and that was a whole trail of privilege for 200 years. I have a connection to it, and I hate to think of that just ruined. And I hope that it doesn't come to that. I hope it doesn't come to that.
What is it? I mean, when you visit still, of course, right?
Oh yes, a lot.
So what is the biggest difference you notice from growing up in this farm place? I think that there's times of the year when it's just full of green for the steer, and there must have been some farmers of other kinds of things other than steer, right?
Oh, yeah.
But now you got fracking. Yeah. They strip it, right? They strip the land. It looks like chemotherapy.
It's tough to watch it. They don't really strip the land, but the infrastructure takes up so much space. Like the pipelines go, flooding through this former pasture. And that's like, 50 yards wide that is just, sort of no man's land with this huge infrastructure gash down the center of it. It's sad. It's sad to see. It alighted in our county, and there was no getting around it. So everyone signed up for the roulette, I guess. And I can't blame them, as you might imagine from like the church talk. There's no industry there. There's no infrastructure there. Right. There's no railroads. There's no airports. So there's very little new industry going there. There's no manufacturing. The coal and steel jobs are gone. So, when they were offered, when the people there were offered a chance to cash in on something, they took it. Yeah. And as much as I would love to judge them for that and say, oh, you're this is what's killing us. I can't. Mm-hmm. I can't.
Right. No. We've forgotten that we are our brothers and sisters keepers, and that we have to take care of everybody.
Yeah.
It's just something that doesn't seem a value. Maybe it was never a value, but it's a value I hold dear.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
So gay. Oh. Ohio.
Oh, gay Ohio in 1980. Yeah.
Tell me.
Wow.
Did you come out there? Or did
no,
you,
God, no.
Okay.
Oh, dear Lord.
Because you're married, right?
I am. I've been with Orville for 21 years.
Okay, so this is a story here. I want to know.
Gosh.
Ohio, because this is a hard thing. There's some people still in Ohio.
Oh, there are a lot of people back in Ohio. And it's a... it's a weird thing. So before I go back to Ohio, recently I posted on social media about my husband, maybe our anniversary or something recently, because we had our anniversary in January, or maybe it was his birthday. And there were comments, lots of comments from people I knew in high school. My first grade teacher.
Commented?
Saying, yeah, like, and that's not unusual. For me to post something about my life, and I'm not certainly not shy about that. But, you know, it still strikes me as a paradox to what I knew back then, or what I thought I knew back then, or how I perceived my world that we all lived in together back then, versus the world that they live in now. And many of these people still live in that same area, and they all know. And to see that kind of support, I'm like, well, I guess the world has taken a step or two forward in ways that I could never have imagined in 1980, because I was very closeted. My father was a very masculine horse riding farmer stock football player. He was a diesel mechanic working on engines the size of, you know, this apartment.
But you had to learn how to do that stuff too.
I had to learn how to do a lot of things on make it right, get it right, figure it out, don't ask for help. Asking for help is weak. That was, you know, one of the sort of...
My daughter gets mad when I say figure it out.
Figure it out. and it was great because I learned how to be self-sufficient. I learned how to figure things out. I learned how to solve a puzzle. But I also learned that needing other people and working together was weak, so it took me a long time to learn how to
play well with others.
Or to manage a team, because I've been in that situation where I'm in a leadership position and I just for a very long time could never delegate effectively because
I had to do it all.
I had to figure it out. I had to get it right, and it all fell on me. And when I let go of that, it was like, whoo. But, you know, growing up in that world, being gay was the worst thing I could imagine.
You were in the closet, though.
I was very much in the closet, but I knew.
Yeah. Do you think your mom or your dad knew?
If they knew, they were willfully ignorant.
Okay. They were choosing, we're going to pretend we don't see that. Yeah, we know how hard that would be. So
they can't have missed the effeminate, skinny, scrawny farm boy twirling baton in the front yard.
Did you do it better than your sister?
I did it better than everyone. I was such a good twirler. Oh my God. But instead I played tuba in the marching band because we didn't have a drum major or any such thing, because our band director would never have a pansy out front.
Gotcha.
Trotting in front of his band. He actually said that to me.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. No, you know.
He said that to you.
Yeah.
Because you were like, hey, look what I can do with the twirling baton. He was like, I'm not having no pansy out front. Okay. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
And, you know, that was the world.
That was the world.
I wasn't looking to open any
closet
doors.
But have you had your baton twirling moment in your whole career now? Have you gotten to do that twirling of the baton? Because I bet the skill is still there.
I once did a flaming baton. No, and that's not a euphemism for anything. That is actually on fire for a summer camp lighting of a bonfire. So I came out with, you know, screaming and whooping and as the, I don't know, the ghost or god of fire, with my flaming baton, throwing it in the air and catching it. And that was the night the lights went out in Georgia.
Wow, that sounds fun.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was the one moment I actually did it in front of people.
I like that. Did you enjoy it?
It was exhilarating. I remember that. Yeah. But I was also really, really nervous, one, that I would drop the damn thing.
And then you would burn up.
And, you know, look foolish. But also, I'm twirling baton in front of a bunch of people instead of just privately on my farm in the middle of nowhere where no one can see me except my parents, who clearly never put that equation
together. Okay. Okay. So where was this that you did this flaming baton? Georgia?
No, it was a summer camp, a 4-H summer camp. Back in Ohio. I was a counselor that year.
And how was it received?
Sort of underwhelmingly. They were like, yay, okay, done.
That was no fun.
It wasn't. But I mean, what do you expect? You're just lighting the fire. The whole evening is a whole, you know, there's a whole
I just watched 2000 Maniacs. Have you ever seen that?
No.
I just heard of it. It's Howard Herschel Gordon Lewis, and it's this campy, he's like the king of splatter gore horror or something like that. And it's this thing where these Southern people lure these Northerners by their license plates to their town to celebrate the 100th year of the Confederates losing the war, and they torture and kill them.
Oh, fun. See, that's a summer camp. That's a summer camp I could get behind.
They're the festivals. They're like, you're the guest of honor. Yeah. You've got to participate. When's that rock going to fall? You've got to tell us as we tie you down. You think it's going to fall yet?
Now I need to watch that.
It's crazy. They like chop off their body parts and barbecue them.
Oh, my gosh.
They put them in a barrel roll with nails in it, so they're rolling down the barrel with the nails in it. It was crazy. Oh. Someone just told me about that movie this week because they were like, that's kind of like your movie, isn't it, Tanya? I was like, kind of. Like, Red Pill is kind of like that.
I cannot wait to see that, by the
me
way.
Me either.
Are you still in post-production?
Still in post-production. Like, I can't wait to see it, too. Now, you were talking about leadership. So you were in the union for how many years? I wasn't in there very long.
Okay, yeah. I got involved when Patrick Quinn, who was the president of Actors Equity back in the late 90s, early 2000s.
So 20 years?
Yeah. I got pissed at him one day and sent him a 3,000-word email about it.
Was there email 20 years
there
ago?
There was, I swear to God. Okay. In 2000 was okay. When this happened. And it was an election year, and he had sent me this, propaganda, and I sent him a very tersely worded email about how I felt about that. And he immediately, within a couple of hours, had sent back like a twice as long email, very thoughtful email to engage with me and to explain his position more fully and to, of course, then say, hey, when you get back to New York, because I was on tour, you should join a committee.
Okay.
Because he saw that writing on the wall. And I did. I joined the Off-Broadway committee. It was the first thing I did. And within a very short amount of time, I was on the negotiating teams for Off-Broadway and for Antic, which were even smaller than Off-Broadway theaters. And I did that. I did that for several years until I was elected to council, and continued that work as well as the council and the Eastern Regional Board work. And I'm no longer on the council, but I am still a trustee of our pension and health fund.
I have to say, the people who do those jobs, people don't understand that this, like, they're full-time jobs and they're not paying full-time jobs. People who are the trustees, figuring out how the insurance works, how the pensions work, how to invest it, people who are negotiating all those contracts, who are making sure people get paid, all of that is electeds and volunteers, and it is unpaid. It's work. It's a lot of work.
It is work. There's a lot of preparation. There's a lot of, and there's a lot of, for me, a lot of pressure, even more on the trustee side than the elected side, because you know, if something is not perfect with the contract, of course it's negotiated, right? So it's never going to be perfect. You know, everyone's going to walk away just a little unhappy if you did your job. But on the trustee side, this is people's lives. This is their retirement. This is their healthcare now. This is when they're people depend on this for their life. So the pressure I feel as a trustee to be well informed, to be prepared, to know what's happening, and to be responsive to that in a thoughtful and fulsome way, it's exciting work, but I take it really seriously because it is clearly a very serious matter for everyone involved.
You're still talking like an elected, Brian.
I know. Wow. I care.
You do care. I can tell you care. I have a question for you, Brian. This is putting you on the spot, but I'm going to do it. We were on a negotiating committee.
Yeah, we were. I was always okay. My job at that in those negotiations, I was leading that negotiation. I put that team together, and we had a really ambitious set of numbers and proposals we put forth. A very focused set of proposals, the very first being salary, period. Salaries need to go up a lot in this arena because they have been stagnant for decades. And this was the one opportunity we had to move that. So my job was to dance that dance for the 6 months it took us to get that contract. We started negotiations in June. The contract didn't expire until November, which means we had to go on the longest first date without putting out for, I don't know if you can say that.
You can say it.
Truly, we needed to be at the table and engaged for all of that time.
Okay.
Whatever time it was going to take.
A lot of foreplay.
It was, but what it meant was, keeping the team motivated and moving forward, always moving forward, but sticking to our guns and keeping everyone focused on what the goal was, which was maybe, yes, we may not be meeting in July and August or even September, but that doesn't mean we're not moving forward because—
I know, but I'm trying to see if you're playing a poker hand with me right now, because I would have put my money on the table that you had to be the person who voted with me not to accept that shitty deal. That's right. It was at the very, very end, and they had not given us the money we wanted.
although we did get—
We did
a hell of a lot of money.
We got a hell of a lot of money. Right before we got that hell of a lot of money, wasn't you, huh, Brian?
No.
Damn.
At that point, I was aiming high,
and actually, it was the day of the day after the election. Hi, this is Tanya Pinkins. That was part one of my conversation with my colleague Brian Myers Cooper.
You is kind. You is smart. You is important. You is dead. Tanya Pinkins' horror film, Red Pill, brings African-American perspective to progressive movement.
We are a majority in this country. And we're going to win the election.
Do you know what the red pill is? A red pill is someone who infiltrates a group and then destroys them from the inside. This place is spooky.
Some people like to live dangerously.
Cass, why are you so jumpy tonight?
You know what, guys? I'm gonna go back tomorrow.
Did you hear about the creature woman that attacked a father and son hunting down here?
I don't see the case. This place creeps me out.
I think we should call the sheriff's office.
The only people missing or dead are brown people.
They're after all of us.
What do we do, Amelia?
We die. But we take some of them with us.
Hi, I'm Tanya Pinkins, and I would love to hear from you. You can text me at 917-724-8998. Tell me what you're up to, and I'll let you know what I'm up to. Text me, 917-724-8998. Let's keep in touch.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No,
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.